This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, makes the case for how racism and race-related political speech has evolved in the U.S. since the Civil Rights era. Lopez is the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Wrecked the Middle Class. He argues that politicians have continually used language to strategically trigger racial imagery in order to scare voters into voting against their own interests. He contends that much of America's social and economic inequality has resulted from these divisive strategies. Ian Haney-Lopez spoke a couple weeks ago at the University of Utah on September 24th, and today we're airing his talk, given to a crowded room of students and faculty at the University of Utah's Hinckley Caucus Room.
Okay, so dog whistle politics, the idea of a dog whistle is it's something where when you blow it, humans can't hear it, but dogs can, because of the frequency. And so it's the idea of a message that's operating on two levels, one silent, the other triggering strong reactions. So think about terms like illegal alien, welfare queen, criminals, welfare cheats, terrorist, thug. All of those terms on their surface do not mention race. And yet all of them trigger strong racial reactions, create strong racial imagery in the minds of voters. I'm arguing that politicians use this sort of coded rhetoric in order to mobilize votes, and that this has been a strategy since the civil rights movement. Essentially, this has been a strategy for about 50 years. It might be more familiar to you, to some of you who've studied sort of politics, as the Southern strategy, right? This is a well-known aspect of political campaigning today. I want to make two points. One, this is far more prevalent than we think it is, especially when we use a term like the Southern strategy. And two, this is a strategy that is not simply connected to winning votes. It's a strategy that's connected to a particular vision of government. And and specifically, it's a way of scaring voters into resenting and being hostile to good government, to liberal government, to New Deal government, right? And here's where I'm going with this. If you want to understand the current crisis of income inequality in the United States today, income inequality for all, you need to think about how race is being used in our political system. So I've ripped this off from Robert Reich. You might recognize this. If you don't recognize this, that means you haven't watched his documentary, Inequality for All. You should watch it, right? Because what Reich is saying is, look, up through just before the Great Depression, there was a surge in the concentration of wealth in the top 1%. And that fell through the Great Depression, through the New Deal. And then somewhere around 1980, income inequality began to surge again. And we are now at levels of income inequality we haven't seen in 100 years. And Reich, in his documentary, talks about some of the policies, especially the tax cuts that have generated this, but he doesn't tell us why the polity, why voters vote for politicians who are enacting these policies. And that's the story I'm going to tell. All right? Okay, so 100 years ago, what's happening? Think about concentrated wealth, Rockefeller, Standard Oil. They have control of the marketplace. They have monopolies. They also have control of government. It's really great for Wall Street. You get the Roaring Twenties, but you also get financial collapse and the Great Depression. In the Great Depression, the country comes to realize, comes to adopt the lessons of the progressive movement that's been struggling with capital the previous 20 or 30 years, comes to realize government must serve everyone, that we are better off when government serves everyone. And what does that mean? That means government must be prepared to provide a safety net when individuals stumble or fail because of injury or illness or because of dislocations in the marketplace, let's say a market crash. That government must provide routes of upward mobility. And what would that mean? That would mean high quality, affordable public education. That would mean access to mortgages so that people can afford to buy property, because that's one of the biggest ways to build equity and enter the middle class. Government must also pool the resources of the country to invest in the infrastructure, because it's through investment in infrastructure that the next great economic expansion will occur. Government must also regulate the marketplace to keep concentrations of power from developing, to keep monopolies from developing. Government must protect people in the workplace from abusive work conditions. It must facilitate the rise of unions. Government must also engage in progressive taxation. What is progressive taxation? That's where we say government should tax the people who've made the most money and use that money to level out income inequality and to fund these other programs. What I'm describing to you is New Deal liberalism. This is the New Deal. This is the New Deal that prompted the biggest expansion in the middle class this country has ever seen, the biggest expansion in the middle class the world has ever seen. And let me be clear, I call it New Deal liberalism, but I'm not saying this is the Democrats and not the Republicans. New Deal liberalism was broadly embraced by both parties. It was a widespread consensus across Democrats and Republicans that you had to have government serve everybody, build the middle class, rather than serve the very rich. That was a broad consensus that took our country through roughly the 1970s. So think about one of the iconic New Deal programs, Social Security. That's Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, right? It was a broad, broad consensus. But there are nevertheless people who continue to object to the New Deal. This is one of them. This is Barry Goldwater. Right? Barry Goldwater elected a senator from Arizona. I have him up here in his senatorial garb. I also have him up here dressed as a cowboy. Right? Now, Goldwater was the son of a wealthy retail family, who nevertheless styled himself a Western cowboy. And it was more than just a sartorial pose, right? It was also an ideology. Because what Goldwater said is, the true man is the rugged individual who takes care of himself, who offers a helping hand to his neighbors, but who never calls upon government for help, who never would force anybody else to help him. If he succeeds, he succeeds on his own. And if he fails, he has the dignity to ride quietly into the sunset and lean up against a tree and suffer and die in silence. Right? This is the rugged individual. This is a powerful ideology. You recognize this ideology, right? And you recognize who this ideology as a political stance is going to appeal to. The rich. Because if you're rich, you can be a rugged individual. If you're rich, you're not going to need help. Even if you experience reversals, even if you suddenly come down with a disease, even if there's tragedy in your family, you can handle it. You're rich. Who else does this appeal to? It tends to appeal to the young, right? Because you're strong. Your whole life is ahead of you. You're doing great. You're getting support from your family. You imagine great successes in the future, and you fail to anticipate reversals, which all of us suffer, right? And you know who this really appeals to, by the way? The high-tech kids in Silicon Valley, because they're rich and young, right? So you've been hearing about sort of libertarianism surging in Silicon Valley. Sure. They've made a mint. They love the story in which they did it on themselves as these, you know, super individuals and nobody can demand anything from them and everybody has to raise themselves up by their own bootstraps because, hey, they did it. That makes a lot of sense if you're young, if you're rich, if you're young and rich. But for the rest of us, it's not reality. It's not reality. There is no dignity in hunger. Right? That is not, right? We need to come together. Right? So here's Barry Goldwater. He's an opponent of the New Deal. He doesn't like government assistance. He doesn't like jobs training. He doesn't like unions. He doesn't like taxes on the rich. And he's going to campaign against all of that. And he knows he's going to lose because the New Deal is popular among the whole country. But he's got a strategy.
If you're just joining us, on the program today, we're airing a talk by Ian Haney Lopez, author of the book Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Wrecked the Middle Class. He spoke a couple weeks ago at the University of Utah.
This is the only bit of text I'm going to show today, right? So this text is important. Here's what it says. A good many, Perhaps a majority of the party's leadership envisioned substantial political gold to be mined in the racial crisis by becoming, in fact, though not in name, the white man's party. This is Robert Novak, a conservative columnist, reporting on what he found after attending the 1963 meeting of the Republican National Committee. This quote is incredibly important. It's important because it says, this is not about racism. This is about strategy. Right? Up to this point, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have been just about equally, tepidly, supportive of civil rights. In fact, in 1960, 27% of African Americans vote Republican. But there's a sense that there's growing white anxiety because of the successes of the civil rights movement, and that the Republican Party can take advantage of that growing white anxiety to win over new voters. And this is a strategic decision to begin to do so. How are they going to do so? And in particular, how is it that in the wake of the successes of the civil rights movement, the Republicans are suddenly going to try and become the white man's party? And that makes sense, except for this little line here, by becoming a fact, though not in name, by using coded terms. Not by saying, we are the white man's party, but by saying, and here's what Barry Goldwater would say, I am in favor of states' rights. What did states' rights mean in 63 and 64? Right? Is this the sort of state-federal relations? Right? This is a sort of federalism abstraction. I teach it in my con law course. Puts my students to sleep. Right? Would you go out and campaign on federalism? I can't get my law students to pay attention. But what was he really saying? What he was really saying is the right of southern states to resist the federal order that they integrate their schools. States' rights meant the right to resist racial integration. Or Barry Goldwater would say, I'm in favor of freedom of association. The right of all of us to associate with, to hang out with people that we want to. That sounds great, but again, pretty abstract. I mean, who's against that, right? But what did freedom of association mean in 1964? It meant the right of white business owners in the South to continue to exclude African Americans. And not just in the South, by the way. In 1974, I was traveling through Arizona, mixed family. My dad's white, my mother's Latina. We were asked to leave a restaurant, right? So it's not just the South, and it's not just African Americans, right? Freedom of association means the right of white business owners to exclude minorities. And this is what Barry Goldwater is campaigning on, right? These are the dog whistles that he uses in 63 and 64. So how'd he do? He was crushed. He was absolutely crushed. Barry Goldwater, 1964, 50 years ago, he's running against Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson is an enormous booster of the New Deal. Lyndon Johnson is telling the country, I am going to expand the New Deal. I am going to declare a war on poverty. We will eliminate poverty in our lifetime through the programs of the New Deal. And Lyndon Johnson wins, and he wins big. He wins all across the country. And indeed, many people respond to the 1964 election by saying, opposition to the New Deal is dead. It's been completely discredited. It has been crushed at the polls. The New Deal is now the common sense core of American political identity. Except, there's a warning rising. There's a warning rising. That's Arizona. They voted for their favorite son. That's the Deep South. Five states in the Deep South, the five southern states with the largest African-American population, voted for Barry Goldwater. And this is shocking. It's shocking. Why? Goldwater is promising to end the New Deal. The South loved the New Deal. They loved it. They were less developed than the North. They were hit much harder by the Great Depression than the North. You know, the New Deal brought electricity. The Tennessee Valley Authority brought electricity to much of the South. They love the New Deal. And they hate Republicans. They hate Republicans in the sense that they hate Lincoln and what they call the war of aggression. But more immediately, it was a Republican governor, Earl Warren, who appointed to the Supreme Court, writes this decision in Brown versus Board of Education that orders school integration. And it's a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, who first orders federal troops back into the South, the first time since the Civil War, to enforce the desegregation order of Brown versus Board of Education. White Southerners hate Republicans. They've sworn for generations they'll never vote for one. And yet here, white Southerners who love the New Deal and who hate Republicans vote for a Republican who promises to dismantle the New Deal. And here's the warning. Even the most diehard supporters of the New Deal, even the most diehard Democrats, can be convinced to abandon that party and vote Republican if appealed to in racial terms. That's the warning. That's the warning.
Ian Haney Lopez is a law professor and the author of Dog Whistle Politics: How Coded Racial Appeals Have Wrecked the Middle Class. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, Ian Haney Lopez, author of the book Dog Whistle Politics: How Coded Racial Appeals Have Wrecked the Middle Class, is examining how race-related language and imagery has been used since the 1960s civil rights movement as a tactic by the conservative right to divide voters and try to win elections. He has spoken nationally about race, politics, and legal issues, and he spoke at the University of Utah a couple weeks ago on September 24th.
Tricky Dick Nixon. He's a moderate Republican. He's not a Goldwaterite. He's a moderate Republican. But he's willing to do what he needs to do to get elected. Should he appeal on the basis of race? In 1968, it's not clear. Right? Goldwater was crushed. It's not clear. The next year, poll watchers and pundits begin to crunch the numbers, and they say, yes, Republicans can break the New Deal coalition of the white working class, Northeastern elites, and African Americans if they begin to use race as a wedge issue. And so Nixon does. Nixon begins to talk. He promises the South that he's going to slow integration in the schools. He says to the North that he's against forced busing. What is forced busing? Putting children on busing was the remedy to promote integration in northern schools. Now, you call it forced busing, and you make it seem as if the issue is having to put your kid on a bus. Parents have been putting their kids on the buses for a century. The issue wasn't the busing. The issue was the integration. So Nixon says he's going to slow integration in the South. He's going to essentially honor states' rights. He's going to oppose forced busing. He says he's going to crack down on law and order, right, and begin to use this issue of crime as a proxy language for race. How does he do? 1972. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson won 67% of the white vote, right? An overwhelming endorsement of the New Deal. In 1972, Richard Nixon wins 70% of the white vote, right? There is a tidal change in American politics between 64 and 72. 8 years, a tidal change. What prompted that change? Right? And I want to argue that what prompted this tidal shift is the rise of racial rhetoric as a way to stampede anxious whites. But this is only half the story. This is the half the story that says race is used to motivate anxious white voters. Here's the other half the story. It really begins with this person, Ronald Reagan. This is Ronald Reagan in 1980. He's just won the Republican nomination to be the presidential candidate in 1980. This is his first official campaign stop. Where does he go? Neshoba County, Mississippi. Well, why is that a well-known place? Because 16 years earlier, three civil rights workers had been kidnapped, lynched, murdered, their bodies found several months later buried in a dike. Right? If you've seen Freedom Summer, this is Neshoba County, Mississippi. Right? Ronald Reagan goes to Neshoba County, Mississippi. In 1980, there isn't a voter alive in that county who who wasn't alive when these three civil rights workers were lynched. And he goes to this county and he says, I believe in states' rights. He goes to the county and he says, using Barry Goldwater's language, I believe in the right of whites to resist integration. Right? That's how he starts his campaign. That's his first official campaign stop. But going back to that graph, remember, income inequality begins to surge. It bottoms out. We're at our most equal in the 70s and 80s. And then income inequality begins to rise again right about 1980. Why? Reagan would tell stories about race when he was campaigning. Here's one of the stories he would tell. He would look out at his audiences, which were overwhelmingly white, and he would say, I understand your frustration when you're waiting in line to buy hamburger and somebody is ahead of you in line to waiting to buy a T-bone steak with food stamps. Now, the first time he told that story, he didn't say somebody. He didn't say some young fella. He said, when some young buck is ahead of you waiting to buy a T-bone steak with food stamps. Now, some young buck is a term out of the South for an African-American man, usually a strong African-American man, one resistant to white authority. And here's the racial imagery. It's not just that African-Americans are disproportionately on welfare or using welfare, it's that they're strong, they could work, but they refuse to work. They'd rather game the system. They'd rather rip off society and live high off of everybody else's money buying T-bone steak with welfare. That's the racial imagery of the African-American, right? And now, I should say, when he first said some young buck, he was subject to a lot of criticism. So he backed off. But he kept telling that story, except he just talked about some young fellow. Everybody understood that young fellow. That was a racialized image of an African-American cheating, scamming, ripping off the welfare system. There's another character here, though. And that is the you in Reagan's narrative. And that you is implicitly white. That you works hard, plays by the rules, struggles to make ends meet. Right? This is the white audience that Reagan is talking to. He's saying, I know you're in trouble. I know you're struggling. I know you work hard and play by the rules. And it's not fair what's happening with these minorities who are ripping off welfare. Right? So those are two main characters. I want to suggest that there's a third crucial character. Government. Who is taking money from the white person and giving it to the undeserving black? It's government. It's government, liberal government, that's reaching its hands into the pocket of the hardworking white, taking that person's hard-earned tax dollars and giving it away to lazy minorities. And so Reagan says, hey, how do we stop this? How do we put an end to this? Tax cuts. We need tax cuts. And voters vote for and support a massive tax cut, massive series of tax cuts during the Reagan administration. Did those tax cuts go to the middle class? Did they go to the working class? No. During the 1980s, the Reagan tax cuts transferred $1 trillion in wealth to the top 1% of the country. He told a story about racial minorities ripping off welfare, provided a solution, tax cuts, and $1 trillion in wealth went to the top 1%. And those tax cuts have never been reversed. So in each decade since, that's another $1 trillion in wealth going to the top 1%. If you want to understand that steep climb in wealth inequality that starts in 1980, you've got to understand the story that Reagan told. He told a story about minorities ripping off the system, about government being the enemy of the white middle class, and people believed it, and what do you do with government then? You starve it.
Ian Haney Lopez. He's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Wrecked the Middle Class.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Willie Horton, what happens over the course of the Reagan administration? Well, you get not only these massive tax cuts, but you get a war on unions, you get financial deregulation, you get massive fraud in the financial industry. I don't know if any of this sounds familiar. Massive fraud in the financial industry, this time in the savings and loan industry. It plunges the country into a deep depression. That has a tremendous impact on home equity values of the middle class and the working poor. And Reagan's vice president, George H.W. Bush, is in big trouble. He's in big trouble, right? The economy is in the tanks. He's in big trouble until he comes up with this ad. This is the infamous Willie Horton ad. This ad, Bush used this to link his Democratic opponent to an African-American who escaped from prison, from furlough program, kidnapped, stabbed, raped a white woman, right? This operated as a dog whistle insofar as the ad never said African-American. It just showed a mugshot, right? And now here's what's crazy about this. 2 weeks before the election, well, here's a couple of crazy things. One, in the month that this ad was running, 12% of the electorate switched its support from the Democrat to Bush. Bush won because of this ad. Two weeks before the election, Jesse Jackson comes out and says, this is offensive racial demagoguery. And the media rises up and says, this is racial demagoguery. This is an offensive injection of race into the conversation. This is mudslinging. This is despicable. Jesse Jackson, shut up! They blame Jesse Jackson. When Jesse Jackson said, hey, this is race baiting, they turned and they blamed Jackson. And it would take 3 years before the media would come to agree that this was an effort to play race in the campaign. And they would only agree after a bunch of investigative research and whatnot, and they had some great quotes. One of my favorites that emerged, one of the Bush campaign strategists said, Willie Horton is a brilliant combination of liberalism and a big black rapist. Like, well, the media got that quote, and they're like, oh, man, maybe they were thinking about race, right? And here's the point. Dog whistling works when it can be associated with plausible deniability, right? You cannot now come out and say, we want to be the white man's party. You cannot explicitly endorse a racial appeal. You've got to make your racial appeals in a way that allows you to deny that it's at all racial. That means that this is constantly evolving. As one sort of appeal becomes too naked, seen as too obvious, you need to have an evolution, and you need some sort of other appeal. So how has dog whistling been evolving? Especially after 9/11, right? I think we've seen a shift, a broadening out of the sort of dog whistle appeals that are common. So dog whistling really comes out of the South, and the main boogeyman is initially African Americans. But after 9/11, we get the idea of a brown external threat to the United States that we trigger by references to the terrorist. But it's important that we don't understand this threat as simply external, because we need to whip up fears in the country, in the heartland, in Kansas, right? And so what do we say? We begin to talk about the way in which this threat is actually within the country, right? And so Kansas passes a law that says that its state courts are banned from drawing on Sharia, from drawing on Muslim religious law when they issue their decisions. And this is needed because obviously the state judges in Kansas were about to draw on Sharia. That was crazy, right? It's crazy to think that state judges in Kansas had the Quran open and were like, well, but it says in the Quran, I'm going to put that in my decision. That was never going to happen, right? But it was symbolic, and the symbolism was these people are everywhere. They're taking over our culture. They're a threat to our way of life, right? And so you, and I think a lot of our rhetoric around terrorism, indeed, look at what we're doing with ISIS, right? So ISIS has, it is a major destabilizing force in the Middle East. ISIS has beheaded a couple of people in gruesome detail, right? But is ISIS the sort of force that is a direct threat to this country? No. But that's not how we're talking about it. We're talking about it as if we're under immediate threat with ISIS. And it's a way, I want to suggest, of stirring racial panic in voters. ISIS is a good segue. You may know that over the last couple of weeks, a lot of Republican representatives in the House have been talking about the problem of ISIS coming across our southern border. Right, that ISIS is in Mexico, and they're going to come across our southern border, and they're going to sneak cars across, and they're imminently going to launch a car bomb attacks. Right, and there's been a lot of talk about all of this. There has long been hysteria about Mexican immigration. And there have been spasms of anti-Mexican hysteria, mass deportation campaigns during the Great Depression, mass deportation campaigns in the 1950s. What happens after 9/11, I want to suggest, is that this fear of Latinos that is regional, the Southwest, California, becomes national. And partly it's because there's greater Latino migration across the country, but I want to suggest that this narrative of a brown external threat to national security invading us and changing our way of life is quickly taken from the Middle East and transferred to Mexico, right? And so this is another dog whistle, I think. All this talk about the insecurity of our southern border, we don't know who's in our country, who are these people flooding across, all the rhetoric of flood and invasion, right, and pointed to, and let me just say, it is the southern border, of course. And I like it when they say southern border because that's like dog whistling. It's just a little more abstract. If they said the Mexican border, that's a little bit more direct. But, you know, let me tell you, I have two brothers-in-law. For a while, one was dating an undocumented woman from Canada, and one was documenting an undocumented woman from Mexico. Did they have the same experience? No. My brother-in-law was dating the Canadian man. They were back and forth up to Canada, traveling or driving across the border. It was easy. It was cool. It was all good. My brother-in-law, who was dating the Mexican woman, they wouldn't go south of L.A. because they couldn't risk being stopped. Right? I mean, we talk in terms of an insecure border or the southern border. These are dog whistles. The fear that it triggers in people is an invasion of dark-skinned Latinos who are threatening our way of life.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Stay with us. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. You're listening to a talk given a couple weeks ago by Ian Haney Lopez, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics. Lopez contends that right-wing Republicans have engaged in strategies to use issues of race and other culture war issues to create hostility towards liberalism for trying to win elections. He says these tactics are, in some ways, to blame for America's social and economic inequality. He spoke a couple weeks ago at the University of Utah.
I'm going to show you a campaign commercial that Mitt Romney ran. This isn't just any campaign commercial. He put half his advertising budget went into this campaign commercial during the summer of 2012, the crucial months.
In 1996, President Clinton and a bipartisan Congress helped end welfare as we know it by requiring work for welfare. But on July 12th, President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. And welfare to work goes back to being plain old welfare. Mitt Romney will restore the work requirement because it works.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
First thing to note, the underlying claim of this ad was simply fraudulent. Obama had not, in fact, gutted the welfare to work requirement. Actually, let me back up just one second. Bill Clinton, welfare to work, Bill Clinton wins election not by defeating dog whistle politics, but by embracing it. So I'm spending a lot of time criticizing Republicans, and they have disproportionately used dog whistle politics, in part because they seek to demonize liberal government. But Democrats have typically responded by imitating it, and that's what Clinton did. Clinton campaigned by saying that he was going to end welfare as a way of life. Who was he talking about? Clinton campaigned by saying he was going to crack down on crime, and he greatly expanded Reagan's war on crime. Who was he talking about? So Clinton himself was a dog whistler. Now comes this ad, and it says, Obama's gotten rid of the welfare to work requirement. Factually false. In fact, PolitiFact does a review of this ad and awards it a pants on fire rating. Is this just a lie, right? It's just a lie. And this is my favorite, this is my single favorite moment in the campaign. A Romney spokesperson stands up and says, we will not let our campaign be dictated by the facts. Oh, why would you? Because you're spinning a myth. You're spinning a nightmare. You don't want to be constrained by facts, right? And what's the nightmare? The nightmare is that liberal government is just about helping minorities, is just giving them welfare. This is the story that Reagan was telling. This is Reagan's nightmare, and they're peddling it again. Except this time the story's slightly different. It's not just liberal government is for minorities. Because now with Obama in the White House, it's liberal government is minorities. It's embodied in minorities. And so the story actually has just a little bit more traction. Okay, I'm going to show you another Romney clip. You know this clip. This is Romney talking about the 47%. And as he talks about the 47%, I want to say this isn't dog whistling, right? Because now he's talking about half the country.
There are 47% of the people who vote for the president. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what. And I mean, the president starts off with 48, 49, 43. He starts off with a huge number. These are people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes doesn't connect. He'll be out there talking about tax cuts for the rich. I mean, that's what they sell every 4 years. And so my job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them. They should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. What I have to do is convince the 5 to 10% in the center that are independent, that are thoughtful, that look at voting one way or the other, depending upon, in some cases, emotion, whether they like the guy or not.
So I don't know who Mitt Romney really is, right? This is not how he governed as governor of Massachusetts. Even if he doesn't really believe this, though, listen to what he's saying. He's saying, I don't need to worry about 47% of the country. I don't need to take care of half the country. And why not? Because they won't take responsibility for themselves. Because they have an entitlement mentality. They think they're entitled to food, to shelter, to health care. Right? I don't have to worry about those people. Now, is this dog whistle politics? Well, it can't be. It can't be, because we're not demonizing minorities anymore. And yet, of course, it is. Because what you see is the rhetoric that has been applied to minorities. They don't take responsibility for themselves. They have an entitlement mentality. They think they're owed all of this stuff. We don't need to worry about them. That rhetoric is now being applied to half the country. Right? To half the country. And think about Romney's policy prescriptions. In the wake of the Great Recession precipitated by financial fraud and misdeeds in Wall Street, Romney says that we need greater financial deregulation. In the midst of a recovery in which 97% of the recovery went to the top 1%, that is, there was a recovery, it just went to the top 1%. The rest of us didn't recover, but they did. Romney says we need tax cuts for the very rich. In the wake of a recession in which people have lost their value in their homes, there's still been very little recovery in the job market, Romney says, we need to cut social services. Right? This is Barry Goldwater on steroids. This is a war on the New Deal liberalism, couched in dog whistle terms about a black president who wants to give people welfare, and about half the country who won't take responsibility for themselves and who have an entitlement mentality and who have the audacity to think that we as a society owe them access to food, to shelter, and to health care, trivial as those things are. Right? That's his message. That's his message. Now, how does he do? How does he fare? Well, you know, he loses. All right, this is Nixon, 1972, won 70% of the white vote. How did Mitt Romney do among whites? This is 2012. Mitt Romney won 59% of the white vote all across the country. And some people say, and this is how they diminish dog whistle politics, some people say, you know, the New York Times actually ran this quote, there's just not enough old white men for the Republicans to win anymore. This is not about old white men. It's not about the South. Mitt Romney won among white men, but he won among white women. Mitt Romney won among older age cohorts. Mitt Romney carried the younger white age cohort too. The youngest whites also voted in a majority for Mitt Romney. There isn't a single demographic, major demographic of whites who didn't vote for Mitt Romney. And it's not just a Southern phenomenon. Mitt Romney swept the white vote in almost the entire country. And this is where we find ourselves today. We exist at a political moment in which one political party, the Republicans, draw 90% of their support from white voters. Among their state elected officials, the Republican Party is 98% white. This isn't accident, and this isn't inevitable. This wasn't, remember I said in 1960, 27% of African Americans voted for the Republican Party, right? In 1964, when Barry Goldwater starts this business, the percent of African Americans voting Republican dropped to zero. Right? It's not accident. It's not history in the sense of the Republican Party's always been white. No, they did this purposefully over the last 50 years by using race and other culture war issues, gender, abortion, same-sex marriage, guns. All of these are culture war issues. They've been using these wedge issues, first and foremost among them race, to convince voters that the real threat in their lives comes from poor minorities or from women or from gays, rather than from concentrated wealth and its ability to capture market power and also government. This is where we're living now. And this is my Facebook page. So I'm going to end here. What can we do? What can we do? I think we need to do three things to turn this country around. First, we need to start talking about good government and New Deal liberalism, not as Democrats, not as Republicans, but simply as people who understand, who are students of government, who are students of society, students of politics, who understand we know what works to build a strong middle class. You need an activist government that cares about the middle class, not a government captured by the very rich. You need a government that provides infrastructure, that social safety net, education, regulate the marketplace, progressive taxation. We know what works, and we need to name those solutions. Second, we need to recognize that as soon as we start talking about these liberal solutions, we will be met with potent narratives of how liberal government is really just for and now by minorities. And we need to be prepared to respond to that, to say, we need a government for everybody. And we refuse to be divided by narratives that say that the real threat in our lives are racial threats. That the real threat in the lives of the American middle class, of the white American, is this brown other ISIS, this brown other, the undocumented immigrant, this black other, the criminal, the welfare cheat. We need to talk forthrightly, explicitly, repeatedly, about how race is being used to divide us in a way that's bad for all of us. And third, and I'll stop here, we need to work inside and outside of both political parties. We need to realize this was once a consensus, New Deal liberalism was once a consensus within both parties, and we need to work within both parties trying to promote candidates who are going to bring back government that's on the side of all of us. And at the same time, we need to realize that after 50 years of this, both parties have been significantly captured by the wealthiest in our society. And they're not going to change if we only work within them. We need also to work outside of those parties. Public mobilization, social mobilization, that's the sort of thing we need to be doing. All right.
Thank you, Professor. We're going to devote the rest of the time for questions from the audience. If you guys have a question, raise your hand. I'll bring the mic to you. State your name and a little information about you and ask your question.
Thank you, Professor Lopez. My name is Kurt Manwaring. And my question to you, I guess, sort of goes back to that New York Times article you quoted that says there's not enough old white men for the Republicans to, I guess, appeal to anymore. And that may be an oversimplification. However, I think we can both agree that the number and the relevance and the power of the minority vote is increasing. So I guess my question to you is, do you see, I guess, that increasing power and that increasing relevance of the minority vote, you know, the minority becoming the majority in some senses, do you see that weakening the power of this dog whistle politics? Thank you.
That's a great question. I'm not sure that it's going to weaken it. I think it's going to challenge it. So here's where we are now. At a national level, if you can get enough women and minorities and working class folks to vote, this sort of dog whistle politics, it's hard to see it resulting in Republican presidencies. So Mitt Romney won 59% of the white vote. The only Republicans who've done better among whites are Richard Nixon in his re-election in 72 and Ronald Reagan in his re-election in 1984. Otherwise, in terms of capturing a proportion of the white vote, Mitt Romney did as well as any Republican has for 50 years. And yet it wasn't enough, on the one hand. On the other, our political system is a system of checks and balances that depends on local elections, on Senate elections, and on House elections. And particularly in the House, we see that there are enough districts in which whites are still are a sufficient majority that this sort of politics continues to play very well. So if you want to understand Tea Party, if you want to understand paralysis in the House, you need to think about how dog whistle politics is being played out locally. So at best, what we have is a system of paralysis that may continue for another decade, another two decades, right? And that's sort of the best. If we don't address dog whistle politics, this is the best that we can hope for. Can we just say, okay, well, we're just going to hang back and wait for a decade or two, and that changing demographics will eventually mean dog whistle politics doesn't work, ceases to work? No. This is strategy. It's not about racism, and it's important to understand this. It's not as if George Bush or Richard Nixon, as if they did this out of a hatred of minorities. They did it because it works. They did it because it allowed them to win. In that same vein, dog whistle politics is likely to evolve in a way that appeals to just enough people to allow politicians to win. Who are they going to start to appeal to? Republicans have been talking about how they need to make inroads among Latinos. Well, a very interesting recent study came out last week. It was published in the Washington Post saying, shocking news, when you look at Latinos by skin color, lighter-skinned Latinos are much more likely to vote Republican. Right? You are likely to see a politics which begins to reach out to lighter-skinned Latinos, lighter-skinned, and I say lighter-skinned, but actually I don't mean that because that makes it seem as if it's just biological. Let me use the word whiter, right? Whiter Latinos, whiter Asians, because that captures the idea that the race here is partly physical, because it matters whether you can pass or not, whether you're accepted as white or not, but it's also a function of educational level, accent, surname, right? That there's a cohort within certain Asian American communities, within certain Latino communities, who effectively can function as white. If they are increasingly accepted as white and appealed to on that basis, I think we'll see dog whistle politics evolve. Let me just try and put this starkly. The census says that whites are going to become a minority in this country somewhere in 2040, 2045. But that's only if Latinos aren't included. Already about half of Latinos identify as white. If the census includes that population, then in 2045, instead of whites being a minority in the country, whites will be 72% of the country. That is, the white population could be expanding, not contracting, could be expanding as a proportion of the country if Latinos who consider themselves white are accepted as white. So in that sense, demography alone is simply not going to save us. We need to be active in contesting dog whistle politics, not just among whites, but also within communities of color to say, hey, this sort of politics is going to play out, is going to try and exploit the sort of racial schisms that exist within the Latino and Asian American populations also.
That's Ian Haney Lopez. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear a full version of this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website and on iTunes. Also, follow this program on Twitter at KCPW Hinckley and hear us every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.